From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, We Were Not Orphans, stories from the Waco State Home.
I could tell you things that would scare you of the treatment in boys who've left there.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides.
I was told that we were coming out to see the two sisters and the brother who were already here. We parked right out front, and we saw my sisters and my brother, and then everybody got back in the car except me, and they were gone. I'm standing right out there in the big middle of the road. I can show you just about where I stood. And I'm crying my eyes out, wondering why they left me. My mother came out here, I believe, one time. That's when I was a little bitty thing. You get to where you don't miss them, really. I had my sisters here. I had my brothers here. And to me, that was my family. Man, I was happy to be here, really. Think back of all the kids who are left out on the street. No place to go. What happens? I can look back on my life out here and say, there but for the grace of God.
That was Roy Duro, a former resident of the Waco State Home. He was there from 1939 to 1952. The Waco State Home was established as the state home for dependent and neglected children by the 36th legislature in 1919. It was in operation until 1979. Anglo children adjudicated by district courts to be neglected were declared to be wards of the state of Texas and admitted to the home for care, education, and training. For many years, what happened inside the walls of the Waco State Home has been only whispered about. Frequently, there was harsh treatment of the children, brutal beatings, and sexual abuse. But life inside the Waco State Home was more than the abuse. The children who were confined at the home grew up there, graduated, and went on to live their lives. Some did better at life than others. Dorothy Robertson Dykeman is one of the many Waco State Home alumni.
This home was just a wonderful home, my home. I have no regrets. I'll never be ashamed. I was 5 years old. My mother couldn't take care of us. I thought to myself, why did she put us all here? I wasn't scared. It seemed like I was in awe just looking around. I made the best of living here. This was my home. I thought to myself, I'm going to be educated. I'm going to do the best I can. And I never did have regrets or got mad. I love my father and my mother, and I'll honor them. But, you know, you can have other fathers. We're all God's children on this earth. We're brothers and sisters, and we're passing through. And if you can't do one good thing, then it's no use to live on this earth. You know, that's the education I got from this home.
My name was Linda. Cooey was my maiden name. My last name's Weeks now. I came here when I was 2 and left when I was 16. We kind of figured out that maybe one of the older siblings was probably the one that was taking care of us. And when she left to get married, then my mother just didn't know what to do with us. So she kind of just left. And our dad, didn't having no options, you know, put us here so that we would be fed and clothed and knew where we were and that we were safe. At first, you kind of blame them because you think, why did he put me out here? Why didn't he keep me? But when you get a little older and you realize that he had done the best he could do, and that the mother, she would come and bring us gifts and stuff. So you kind of think, oh boy, she's come to bring us gifts, but it was kind of like a bribe to make us like her, because she knew, you know, that she was the reason we were here. It was good and bad, you know. Being as young as I was, I kind of got left in the dorm there, since I was the only one that wasn't old enough to be in kindergarten. So I stayed in that dorm, and there was a house parent there who molested me and my sister as well. And at the age I was, of course, I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know exactly what or how to go about resolving it. I guess it makes you stronger, you know, when you have to live through something like that. And I would not ever do anything to hurt my children, because, you know, I learned to love them maybe more than most parents do. There's no reason to be bitter. If God can forgive the people he forgave, I can forgive him.
There wasn't a big budget for the Waco State Home. It had to be more or less self-sustaining. The boys assisted with farm, garden, and dairy work, and the girls with laundry, housekeeping, and the dining room. John White was in the home from 1940 to 1953.
And that's just the thing. Everybody's deserted you. Then they just pitched you out here amongst the wolves, and you had to do it or die, you know. My life skills were ruined from being here. I didn't know anything about life. I didn't know how to dial a damn telephone. And so here I am trying to catch up on life, and that's why I didn't get an education. You know, I just couldn't go to school. I was just busy in life. And my life after the Waco State Home, I survived for a man called Leo White. He was my dad's brother, my stepdad's brother. And he got me and took me to Woodsboro, Texas. And I lived with him. We always wondered about the guys that didn't make it. And I know that there's a lot of guys that was here that, man, played football with us that didn't survive. You know, they didn't have good homes. They were in prison, and, you know.
The stories of the former residents of the Waco State Home would have all been forgotten, except for the efforts of Sherry Matthews. She's written a book based on state records and the oral histories of the alumni called We Were Not Orphans, Stories from the Waco State Home.
Well, when I was 3 years old, I watched my three brothers driven off to live there, and they were there for 5 and 6 years. Well, the Waco State Home was a home for dependent children, and most of the children there had parents. That's why they are always quick to say we were not orphans, but their parents simply couldn't take care of them. And the home opened during the Depression years in the 20s and 30s. And then the South, and especially Texas, had very, very difficult economic times, not just because of the Depression, but because of the Dust Bowl years. And so a lot of the farms were just not producing at all. And so people were frankly starving. And so a lot of parents who never before had experienced poverty found that they simply could not feed their children. And so that's why you hear a lot of the stories of the 20s and 30s, they talk about the bountiful food and how delicious the food was. It's because some were eating dirt when they went to the home. In my particular case, after a series of family tragedies, my mother ended up with 5 children. The husband was gone. My great uncle, who had a 150-acre farm, chose not to have 5 children live on the farm. And he said, I'll take the baby girls. And that was my sister and me. And so we and my mother went to live on the farm with my uncle. But because he would not take my brothers, they were sent to the Waco State Home. In the early days, there were probably 200 children at the home. But during the Depression years, there were 300 or 400 and a waiting list of another 200. So there were a lot of people who simply could not take care of their children. And again, these were the years when there were no food stamps, there were no aid to dependent children, there was no subsidy for housing, there was no safety net. And if you couldn't feed your children and you didn't have relatives who would help you, then you really didn't have a place. I mean, you didn't have any choice except something like the Waco State Home. What I think is interesting is when people say, well, it takes money to fix something like this. Well, I have to disagree, because it was in the 30s, in the Depression years, that Robert Patterson, one of the greatest superintendents of the home. He was only there 2 years, but he was excellent. And he made a point of interviewing his staff every week, face-to-face, alone, quizzing them. He walked around the grounds with the children. He talked to the children. Has anyone ever touched you? Does this? Asking questions. He made sure, and he treated the children as though they were his own children. I mean, they thought of him as their father. He was a wonderful man. Well, he was fired so his job could be given to a man who had never had any experience with children and turned out to be one of the worst and most abusive superintendents in the history of the home. But he was given that job because his family was wealthy and they had donated to the governor's race.
Matthew's book started out as a collection of happy stories about the Waco State Home. That's all she had heard about the state facility, although not from her brothers. They refused to tell her about their years at the home. But as Matthews began to record the stories, little by little, the hidden side of life at the Waco State Home was exposed.
There was a caseworker who later became a leading official of the home. And he was, in his younger days, he was a caseworker there. And he molested, he actually raped boys and girls. And he stalked them, and he knew when they would be alone or when they would be vulnerable. And if the girls who were raped got pregnant and they revealed what had happened to them, he had them declared insane, and they were sent to the Austin State Hospital. And it was called an asylum during some of those years. And so one woman story is that she went there. And her sister, the woman died, but her sister told me the story. She got pregnant. She was sent there, and the doctor said, "Well, you're not insane. You're just pregnant." She said, "I know." And he said, "Well, we will see that the baby is put up for adoption. We will find you a job, and you don't ever have to go back to the Waco State Home." And so she didn't. So she never went back. There were other stories of women who ended up at the state hospital and died. One woman died there 33 years later. And for a long time, the siblings nor the parents knew where she was. I mean, children could be adopted, and the parents didn't have to sign, and they were never told. I mean, they would come to see their kids, and they were told they'd been adopted.
The abuse was there. It was real. Nonetheless, many of the Waco State Home alumni today say they were not aware of it. Some, like Russ Duro, who was there from 1939 to 1952, paint an almost idyllic picture of their years there.
The state leased two farms near the lake. The high school boys worked on those. We raised all our vegetables, which were brought back to the home. Some were served as fresh vegetables, and the rest was canned for future use. We also raised grain and grass and baled hay. The grain was mixed and fed to our livestock and chickens. On weekends, we'd butcher at least four hogs, sometimes a beef steer or a bunch of chickens. The last year I was there, I was in charge of feeding the pigs. We exhibited the best ones at the Fat Stock Show in Fort Worth. Our pigs took either first or second place in each of the four categories, and one of them was a reserve grand champion. The only pets we could keep were pigeons. We used scrap lumber and chicken wire and built a pigeon house. One year we took some of them to the state fair, turned them loose, and they were waiting for us when we got back home. In high school, I believe we had some of the best teachers in the whole state. My favorite teacher was my English teacher, Mrs. Vernon Legg. When I first started going back for a reunion, I'd always get a big hug from her. I felt I was her prized student. I'd say to everyone, "Yeah, she learned me everything I knowed about language." A couple of years before I left, Mrs. Baltz taught us square dancing, which was a lot of fun. We went to square dance exhibitions all over Houston, Austin, Fort Worth. We were really, really good. The high point of my square dancing career was when we went to the Watermelon Festival in Atlanta, Texas. The original square took first place, and they got a plaque. My square took second, and we got a watermelon that weighed 120 pounds.
One of the most infamous accused abusers to have worked at the Waco State Home was C.B. Buddy Wiggum. Wiggum and his wife worked at the home off and on for nearly 20 years.
Wiggum was a coach and a dorm parent who worked at the Waco State Home over 20 years, and it looks as though he was fired, we think, at least three times. And he kept coming back. We don't know why or how. No one knew his history or why they would hire him. Some of the superintendents, frankly, I think were abusive, and that's why they brought him back. If you terrorize children with a disciplinarian like Wiggum, then children aren't going to talk because they're way too afraid of being beaten. And they're also afraid of being sent away to some worse facility. I mean, the Waco State Home for some children, that was all they ever knew. And so they knew, okay, this is bad, but I know what it is. But I don't know what the other thing is that they're threatening me with. Well, Wiggum was a coach, and as some of them told stories, he could make the kids feel wonderful. Sometimes he could be funny. It almost seems as though he was some kind of psychotic personality, that he was a dual personality, because he would do things that would make the kids, just like they said, feel like a million bucks, you know, if you were a good athlete. He really encouraged that. And he could be very supportive and really make you think you were fabulous if you were a ball player or a football player or whatever. But he could suddenly turn around after he's praised you and then you dropped a ball or fumble or something, he would punch you in the mouth and knock out your teeth. I mean, the kids said they never knew what to expect from him, and everybody just tried to toe the line or stay off his radar screen. He beat them with a plain baseball bat. He also had two strips of leather that were harnesses from a horse plow, and he took both of them, and he would beat the kids until they bled. I mean, he broke bones of children with a baseball bat. He swung that baseball bat at Buddy Tucker in one of the stories, and Buddy stuck up his wrist and his hands to protect his head, and he broke his wrist. That's how hard he swung the bat at a boy's head. I mean, he was a monster. There's no question about that man. He was clearly somebody who took delight in abusing and really destroying the self-esteem. He drove many children away from the home and sent them to places that were even worse, like Gatesville, and some ended up in prison. He was a sadist.
John L. Smith lived at the Waco State Home from 1942 to 1952 and played on the school's football team, which was coached by Wiggum.
Most of us like sports, and C.B. Wiggum liked coaching, and he was good at it. He got us into a lot of good contests. We had a little football team, a little 90-pound team. This was about 1947, 1948. We had no shoes. We played barefoot. We had some old beat-up jerseys from no telling when. No shoulder pads. Our trousers and an old helmet you could just about fold up and put in your pocket. The other teams would have their tennis shoes, shoulder pads, nice helmets and everything. But we were pretty good for little kids, and we beat everybody in the little league in Waco. Wiggum was as happy as he could be when he got us a match with the Masonic Home in Fort Worth. On a Saturday morning, he drove us up to Fort Worth in a driving rain. We get here, eat lunch, go out and play those kids, and they've got all this equipment. They have everything, and we have nothing. And it's cold and rainy. It was an exciting game, but they beat us 7-6. When the game was over, we didn't go back to a dressing room. We didn't go in and take a shower. We got our bare feet on the bus and drove back to Waco. And I'm telling you, we loved it. We got to make the trip to Fort Worth, and we damn near beat those bad sumguts. You'd have thought we'd played for the national championship. Wiggum could do things like that. He could be so nice and make you feel so good, then the next minute he'd be beating the hell out of you. And that's a crying shame.
The stories of Wiggum's abuse are common with the boys who lived at the home during his years there. In the book, We Were Not Orphans, there are about 50 accounts of him terrorizing the children. But one alumni, Tommy Turner, is able to tell the story of the night the boys turned the tables on Wiggum.
There was a boy in our junior high dorm named David who had a horribly disfigured leg from an auto accident. He was a weightlifter and strong, had a strong upper body. So he was by no means weak. He was just not able to participate in most athletics. So Mr. Wiggum had little use for him and constantly picked on him. One day David had been disciplined, but after bedtime Mr. Wiggum pulled him out of bed and took him into the locker room. We heard a struggle, loud voices, locker slamming. About six of us, including some of the boys who made up three sets of twins who lived in the Wiggum dorm, rushed to the locker room. What we saw was a fist fight, not a discipline, and Mr. Wiggum, who had a lump on his head and a bloody nose, had David in a headlock. We attempted to separate the two, and Mr. Wiggum hit one of our boys in the face with his fist, starting an all-out brawl. No matter how hard we pounded on Mr. Wiggum, he would not let go of David's head, so we kept fighting. No one was seriously hurt, but we gave him a good thrashing that night. We were just tired of him and his brutality, for we'd all been on the receiving end. Mrs. Wiggum heard the disturbance in the locker room and came in her nightrobe. She saw her husband on his knees on the floor, his white T-shirt covered with blood. She started crying and screaming, "Don't hit him anymore, let him alone," and rushed out of the room for help. Mr. Wiggum tried to scold us, but he was crying a little, but that didn't evoke any emotions in us. We had had it with him. There wasn't an ounce of blood on anyone except David, and that was Mr. Wiggum's blood. Mr. Balch came, talked to the Wiggums, and then interviewed each boy individually. We expected to be expelled from the home, but none were. I believe the Wiggums were later reassigned. I was soon moved to the senior boys' dorm, and I never saw Mr. Wiggum again. He finally got his comeuppance because we cleaned his plow that night.
Even at the Waco State home, love finds a way to take root. Bess Foster Tucker was at the home for 2 years, from 1960 to 1962, and that's where she met the man she would marry.
Each summer, the Mr. and Mrs. Gay would take us on a vacation. One year, we went to Galveston. Another time, we stayed in cabins at a camp near Austin. Those were the innocent days. We were carefree. That was when our great country was innocent, before JFK was assassinated, before we were attacked on 9/11. We made those vacation trips and rode to school in a big yellow bus with Waco State Home printed on the side in big, bold black lettering for the whole world to see. As teenagers, of course, we were embarrassed about being seen getting on or off this bus. As an adult, however, I have never been embarrassed about being at the Waco State Home. I have never felt sorry for myself for being there. I would have felt sorry for myself if I had not. In my junior and senior years, I received a lot of honors. I was Spring Festival Queen, Homecoming Queen, and Spirit Sweetheart. This was the same young girl who hid in the restroom in junior high in Austin because she did not have proper shoes to wear. I made a promise that one day I would have 100 pair of shoes. In our junior year of high school, we could double date. In our senior year, we could go on a single date. In January or February of 1960, with a lot of snow on the ground, I met Buddy Tucker. Mr. Al Burns, the house parent in the big boys' dorm, called Dorm 7, I believe, was pulling the boys on a sleigh behind his car. I bounced a snowball off one of the boys and started walking back to the dorm. Suddenly, I was pushed to the ground, and my face was rubbed in the snow by Buddy. Well, it went from there. We started going together, and upon graduation from high school, we were married. That was June 1962, and now, 49 years later, he is still the love of my life.
Buddy and Bess Tucker always wear matching red, white, and blue outfits. They behave like newlyweds. And it was due to Bess that Buddy ended up having a dramatic exit from the Waco State home.
The reason I left is I was going with my girlfriend and wife now. And we'd gone to Fort Parker on a picnic. And her house parent was Mr. Gay, who never did like me. I don't know why. We're coming back from the picnic on the bus. He wanted to fight, and I told him I don't want no trouble. And so he kept pushing it.
finally I said, all right, let's just do it. Then he got back in his seat, we get back to the home, and I start to unload, and he's in front of the bus. And he said, Tucker, your parents had to be the sorest people in the world to have a boy like you. And I lost it. The knives were there for cutting the barbecue, and I went after him. I mean, I was going to kill him. Only because I was so mad I couldn't think. Well, just about the time I caught him, Al Burns caught me. He seen what was coming, and he stopped it. Well, after all the police and the superintendents and all, I was backed up on what was said because of my reputation as never lying to him about anything. Made sure that Mr. Gay didn't come anywhere near me, and so I had been working part-time, going to school part-time, and had bought me a 51 Plymouth station wagon. Well, about 2 weeks later, I decided I better get out of there because it's not going to end. Somebody's going to get hurt. So I just grabbed my stuff, got my little old station wagon, and off I went. That was my motorhome, and I never went back. I was 18. You're a ward of the state till you're 21. And I finished up my school, but they tried to kick me out of school and make me join the Army. And I wouldn't go because I was a ward of the state. I knew that. And they couldn't kick me out of the school. So they said, well, you had to have a guardian to go to school. So a guy I worked with made me a guardian. He got me a guardian. And then my wife and I now decided to get married. The state said she can get married. She's 18, but you're not 21. You can't get married. Well, I knew Judge Ray Mormino, which I'd met him over the years through my problems, and I went, took her, and we went to see him, and he felt my pain, certified me as an adult, and I got married, and here we are.
So I have family kids?
Yeah, we got two kids, three grandkids.
How did you learn how to be a parent?
Didn't.
We learned on our own.
On our own. We wasn't taught nothing. They don't teach you nothing. They don't tell you what you're going to need to do to make a living. They got no money.
We didn't want to treat our children. We knew, you know, right from wrong. We knew not to mistreat our children and just love them, you know. And I tease people today, we stayed married, you know, all these years, not, you know, because we love each other, but I had no place to run. I couldn't go back home.
We got in trouble. No,
we were on our own. He couldn't go back home. His parents had divorced. Mine stayed together. But I certainly would not have gone back home. That's the reason why I left home, to come to Waco for a better life.
What to make of the Waco State home? Was it a central Texas utopia? Through the narrow lens of nostalgia, it could be. It certainly was a crude social safety net that fed, sheltered, and clothed thousands of impoverished children. Was it a chamber of horrors? At times, yes. And it didn't have to be. Matthews wants future generations to remember the Waco State home and to know that wherever there are children being cared for and there is a little oversight of the adult workers, there is the possibility of abuse. If we don't go looking for it, injustice will prevail. C.B. Wiggum was never prosecuted for his brutality. In 1970, he retired from working at the Waco State Home and was praised by local officials and in the newspaper for being a loving parent to the thousands of Texas children who were placed in his care. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. A special thanks to Sherry Matthews, author of We Were Not Orphans, Stories from the Waco State Home. It's published by the University of Texas Press. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.